Y'all looking at a beautiful young man on the screens right now, and I don't even know where to start here. Matthew Pack is someone who came through Pack Hills, Pacific Hills Treatment Center, and through us about 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago. And if you could have seen him then, as I remember him the first time I saw him, we were at another location in San Clemente at that time doing a Tuesday night recovery gathering. And he showed up and he had this stocking hat on, so you could only see this much of his face. And he was fresh from West Virginia, where he had almost killed himself in a car crash induced by his using, of course, and had tried to commit suicide. And this kid had a look in his eyes that was sort of a mix between deer caught in the headlights and I dare you to try to teach me something. It was like that. And he became one of our dearest children here. And I had the privilege for almost a solid year, I don't think we missed a Friday, he and I, of sitting down and talking for an hour and a half, 2 hours, sometimes even longer. You have heard of Tuesdays with Maury. This is like Fridays with Matt. And he taught me as much as I ever taught him. And the interesting thing about Matthew is that he started out as a confirmed atheist, agnostic at least, and he really struggled with the whole Christian thing. You know, fortunately, we here are not terribly religious. You'll find that out if you come a few times. We are staunch followers of Jesus, though, and that was something that he really struggled with. And through all of our times together, we struggled with that, and we're talking about that. Then he just got healthier and healthier, though, as I watched him. That look in his eyes left him, and he became this transformed individual. He went to school at Concordia and got his degree. And the thing about Matt is, from West Virginia, that was hard for me to get my arms around and comprehend, being a city guy from East L.A., where everything was concrete, was that the outdoors were his life. Everything to him was about being outdoors, and he wanted to follow a career path that would get him out there. And he was completely unafraid. He took a bike ride from Vancouver, B.C., down here all by himself. He went to Panama by himself and ziplined and did whatever he did there. He went to India. He was always just heading off someplace to do something by himself. And last Friday, he went rock climbing, doing a solo descent by himself, and fell. And so we just found out yesterday that he's gone. And it's just like losing one of our children. And on one hand, we are so... I guess I should say, I'm so frustrated and saddened by a life that held such promise. On the other hand, he didn't waste any time, and he was always out there doing exactly what he wanted to do, and he did that, and that's an inspiration for all of us. Not that we have to go rock climbing or zip lining or go to India to find what he was finding on the inside through his celebration of nature and the outside. But this morning, it can't be separated in my mind from Matthew, and for those of us who knew him, I know it's the same. For those of you who didn't know him, just look at that face and you can get a sense of what's going on inside that young man. And it really started to connect with me as I was continuing to prep for this morning, because we've been going through the Lord's Prayer line by line. There's 5 lines in the prayer. We're on line 3 now. So for those of you who are new with us, you're coming in the middle. I'll try to get you caught up. But the way that Matthew lived his life and the way that he... You know, think about it this way. I don't know how many of you rock climb or do any of these extreme sports. I haven't done much except skydiving. I did that once. But I can imagine clinging to a rock face that you have to be so completely immersed in the moment. You have to know where every foothold is, where every toehold is. You are scouring the rock face to look for the next one, where to place your anchors and supports. You're constantly measuring the tackiness of your hands. Is it time to go into the rosin bag for some more? And you are so completely immersed in that moment. And of course, the sense of danger heightens all that and forces you. I guess that's why we like thrill rides and like extreme sports, because they force us into that moment. I've heard people say, I never felt so alive as when I was facing death. And that's true. But wouldn't it be nice to be able to live our lives so that we don't have to face death in order to celebrate the moment? And so Matthew is just bringing all this home to me as we come this morning to talk about daily bread and what that daily bread really means in Jesus' Aramaic sense of the word. I wanted to reread the Lord's Prayer in Aramaic, and I put the transliteration in the bulletins this morning. So if you want to follow along with me, one of the themes that we've been talking about here is that it is so hard for us as Westerners to understand an Eastern text. And make no mistake, Jesus was an Eastern man, and we're trying to look at him through a Western lens, and it doesn't fit right, and it changes the meaning. So right in the center of your page there, as you open it up, there is the Lord's Prayer written in Aramaic, and it reads from right to left, so you got to go backwards, in the Astrangula script that it is normally written in. Underneath it is an English transliteration. And even the sound of the language it sounds alien, but it's beautiful. And I'm going to do a poor pronunciation, I guarantee you. You probably won't know the difference unless you're Aramaic scholars. But just listen and follow along. Avundavashmaya Nitkarashamak Tete Malhuta Neve Sevyanach Aikana Davashmaya Afbara Tavlan Lakma Disunkana Nyomana Vashbochlan Hoven Aikana Davchanan Shukhan Tchayaven Vela Tatlan Lenesyuna Elapatsan Membisha Mento Dilache Malchuta Vahaila Vatushbukta La Alam Almin Amen. Just love the sound of it. And if you can hear a native speaker, it just comes across so much. All those round, open vowels, and it just sounds to me like the earth. And as you look at those lines, and you look at the translations on the other side, on the right side, you start to get a sense of a very different picture that is being formed here. You know, what was Jesus trying to convey? What was he trying to tell us? Not just here in these five lines, which are really a concentrated form of his entire message. But what was he trying to convey with his life, with everything? And I think that's the key. If you want to understand Jesus, you can't separate his sayings and his teachings from who he was. Who he was completely integrated and connected with what he said and taught and asked us to do. So probably the better question is not what he's trying to say, but who was Jesus? Who is Jesus? If we can answer that question, then we can start to get a sense of what this whole thing is about. What is the nut? What is the kernel? And how does it shift and change from what we normally think of as a prayer that we simply recite? Something that is so familiar that we don't even have to think about it anymore. But what did Jesus say about himself? He said, I and the Father are one. He said, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. And I'll never do anything except that which was initiated by my Father. Now, religiously, theologically, as a Christian church for 2,000 years, we say that Jesus is the Son of God. Jesus is God. But how are we supposed to understand that? And then we hear Jesus telling us again, I and the Father are one. If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. In other words, Jesus is the living representation of the Father. For all intents and purposes, when we are standing in front of Jesus, we are standing in front of the Father. There is nothing that we will see in Jesus that we won't see in the Father. And so this first line of the prayer is taking us right there. And if you want to condense down Jesus' message, basically his whole life was showing us the Father, showing us who the Father is, giving us a sense. And so that first line, Avunda Vashmaya, our Father in heaven, we think from Western point of view, it's an email address. It's where we send the messages, up there someplace. You know? And nothing could be further from the truth. That keeps God remote from us. He's out there someplace, and we have to send these messages. The whole first line is tied to a single word in Aramaic, which is Shem, which we would translate as name. But actually, if you go back to the roots, it means light, sound, and vibration. It was the, to the Hebrews, the outward appearance of something that was a window to the inner essence, character, reputation. So that's why Hebrew names are so important. They always told something about the person. They were significant. And so Shemaya, the word for heaven, is Shem plus A-Y-A, transliterated, Aya, which meant extended without limit. And so the Shem of creation, this light, sound, and vibration without limit, were the skies, the heavens, the place of God's breath, which Ruha was breath, wind, and spirit, all in one, meant all those things at the same time. And so Shemaya, this place of God. So what we're saying here literally is that our Father's name is Shemaya. In other words, all of creation, all of heaven, are that window into His essence and His character and His nature. If we could live our lives in such a way that we went through life looking at this incredible world that we inhabit and the incredible people that we inhabit it with and seeing the face of God and the essence of who He is behind them, how would that change your days? How would that change your moments? And then the next part, Nitkara Shemak, hallowed be your name, which sounds like we're just saying nice things about God in emails and sending them up to heaven. You know, when I was a Catholic growing up, it was the Baltimore Catechism. Why are we here? To glorify God, which to me meant, oh, we say nice things about God. I'll tell you what, if God is all-knowing, He already knows those things. If He's all-powerful, I don't know that He really needs us to say them. And if He's all-good, then He probably has something better for us than just to sit around saying nice things about Him. So what does this glorify mean? What does this hallowed mean? Kadosh there, that central word. And if it's confusing to you about where these words go in this transliteration, it's because an ancient Semitic language like Aramaic doesn't have all the little connecting words like English does, conjunctions and prepositions and articles. They just pack on to each word prefixes and suffixes that tell that story of what all those connecting words. So buried in there, in Nitkadash is Kadash, which means to make holy, but in the sense of setting something apart, clearing the space. The roots of the word go all the way back to the agrarian beginnings of the Hebrew race, where the image is of someone bent over a piece of land and preparing the soil for planting and for new life. So when we go through this world seeing the face of our Father in creation, and then we take the time to clear a space, both interiorly and exteriorly, to let that nature sink in deep to who we are, that's the meaning of the first line. It's not meant to be said, read, recited. It's meant to be lived out. And then the next line, your kingdom come, your will be done. Two parallel phrases there that basically mean the same thing. The two parallel words are kingdom and will. Will in Aramaic, sebyana, which doesn't mean will the way we think of it, but it's delight, desire, deepest purpose, pleasure. The deepest purpose of God is His kingdom. The kingdom is us living and the quality of life that we can have when we are living that deepest purpose, desire, and delight of our Father. So your kingdom come, your will be done, as in heaven, so on earth. In other words, as important as it is to you, God, let my heart feel the same desire and pleasure. Let us resonate together. Let there not be this big separation between heaven and earth. Bring heaven to earth and earth to heaven. And so the transliterations, or I should say the translations, are the paraphrase, really. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Our Creator and parent of all. All creation carries the signs of your love, desire, and purpose by which you are known. We clear a special place for you, for your love, desire, and purpose in our hearts and lives. Your kingdom come, your will be done, as in heaven, so on earth. May your desire and purpose become as real in our hearts and lives as they are in yours. And so this way of living life in these first two lines is designed to bring heaven to earth, bring the unity of God into our lives. But if we just stop there, you know, we have the danger of becoming a very introverted kind of spirituality, or living an introverted spirituality, one that doesn't really connect well. You know, we can become a race of navel gazers out in the steppes of the mountain someplace, really not connecting, really not bringing anything of value back to community. And so these next three lines are going to lock that in for us. They're going to change. Instead of now bringing praise to God and bringing that connection and unity to us, now we're going to start asking for things. These are three petitions. But they're not random petitions. And the fact that there are three is significant, because three meant completion and wholeness. And so these three petitions are meant to represent all the things that we need in this life. And they end up in three specific areas. First, we're going to ask for this daily bread. And we're going to have to talk about that today. But that's dealing with the provision of life. Let there be provision. The second, dealing with debts and debtors and forgiving our debts, deals with relationships and bringing good relationships into our lives. And the third, about not being led into temptation or evil, is not being diverted from that true purpose that we prayed for in the second line. Provision, relationship, non-diversion of purpose. These are the three things that sum up everything that we need in order to bring earth to heaven. To elevate our lives and the lives of the community around us to this place. Everything is meant to be lived out. That is what Jesus is mostly trying to get across to us. And these next three lines are going to ground us in the earth, ground us in community, ground us in relationship. Do y'all remember Casey Kasem? Remember him, if you're old enough, the American Top 40? And I didn't realize, but he was the voice of Shaggy and Scooby-Doo. How about that? He had dozens of voiceover characters. He had a signature line that he always signed off with. Can any of you recite what his signature line was? Every time I heard him sign off the American Top 40 back in the day, he said, "Keep your feet on the ground and keep reaching for the stars." Remember that one? You got to say with Casey's voice, though. It was just so cool. Keep your feet on the ground and keep reaching for the stars. Do you see how these two parts of the Lord's Prayer, the first two lines and the second three lines, are doing exactly that? If we just had the first two, we'd be reaching for the stars, we'd be reaching for heaven, and we would forget our roots. We would be so heavenly minded, as often said, that we're no earthly good. You ever heard that one before? And we all know that we've erred in that area if we've tried so hard to be pious and to be what we think we're supposed to be as spiritual religious people. And we forget that our roots are in the ground. Our roots are in the earth and with everyone around us. And so these second three lines are going to ground us there and keep us where we need to be. And so this next line, and the way it would translate directly from the Aramaic, give us the bread of our need this day. Much better than, you know, give us our daily bread. In Aramaic, havlan lachma sunkanan yomana. So this idea of lachma, bread, is really important. In the Aramaic language, it's made up of roots, which are just two letters. And each letter means something. And then they just add letters onto that to create words and child roots and so on and so forth. A word that is connected by roots has a similar meaning. Lachma is connected to chokma. And chokma is wisdom. It's wisdom personified. If you read Proverbs, if you read Ecclesiastes, you will see wisdom personified always in the feminine. You know, it's a feminine wisdom that counteracts the masculine executive nature of the father. But wisdom and bread are connected. Lachma isn't just our physical food. It's not just our physical needs being met. It's everything. It's understanding. It's wisdom. It's spiritual and mental and emotional health and sustenance as well. It's all of our needs that we could possibly have, and the provision for those needs flowing through this idea of lachma. And what are these needs? Sunkanan. Again, going to the root of sunkanan, right inside there are two letters, kuf and nun in Aramaic. And the kuf, the original pictograph symbol, was a circle with a line through it, and it was the sun at the horizon. And in the Hebrew mind, that was the point either at sunrise or sunset where all the light was gathered to a single point and either expanded or contracted into evening. And so this kuf was understood as a gathering, a collection. And then Nun was a picture of a germinating seed. You had a little seed and a little sprout coming out of it. And so Nun was a seed. So literally, Ken is a gathering for the seeds. And that Ken means nest. And so Ken is a nest, and it's a circular nest. And it's built by the Kana, the builder, also coming from that same word, Ken. Just adding the letter het, which we would transliterate as an H. And the builder bird builds the nest for the nestlings, for the next generation, for their offspring. And then cares for them and gives them every provision, everything that they would need. They just stay in the nest. They don't move from the nest. They don't move from that circle. All right. So Sunkhanan means a circle of need. Literally. All the provision comes into the circle. Just as an aside, have you ever heard of God being described as a jealous God? Didn't that always kind of tweak you? Because what in the world is God being jealous about? And how does that fare with me? If I'm the unfaithful spouse and he's a jealous God, well, then I'm in big trouble, right? Because we understand jealousy to mean anger directed toward the unfaithful partner, the unfaithful party, the spouse, right? But jealous in Hebrew is kana. Coming from Ken, just adding the Aleph at the end, but we would be a letter A. And so the idea is not an anger directed at an unfaithful party, but the passion with which the parent bird guards the nest and the nestlings. You know, the anger, if you even want to think of it that way, is directed outward at those who would invade the nest and harm the nestlings. That's God's role in our lives as a jealous God. The passion with which He provides for us within our circle of need and guards us within that circle of need. And so this idea of the circle, what is the circle? It's Yomana. Not to be confused with Yomama. I had to say it, I'm sorry. Yomana, this day. And Yoma in Aramaic is any finite period of time. It can be long, it can be short, and it can be this moment. But the circle is this day, this moment. That's our circle. If you leave the nest, if you leave the circle, you leave the protection and the provision of your parent. If we leave the moment, if we leave the day, we leave the protection and provision of our Father in heaven. Everything happens this day, this moment. This is what Jesus is trying to get across to us. This is what His Father in heaven is trying to teach us, that it's about this day, this moment, and none else. So how would we translate that? Again, on your sheets there, help us see that everything we need for this day, this moment, is contained in this day and this moment and nowhere else. Where else you gonna go? You know, Fox Mulder, X-Files, the truth is out there. Fundamental flaw in his thinking. If you leave the nest, what are you gonna find? The Hebrews had a word for that too. It's called outer darkness. There was nothing out there outside of the nest, outside of the circle of possessions, the circle of need. Dorothy Gale in The Wizard of Oz, you know, longing for something over the rainbow, only to find at the end of her journey that everything she needed was right in her own backyard, within her circle of possessions and need. This moment, this day, she didn't need to go out there. Some other interesting translations of this line, in a more poetic fashion. See if they just kind of resonate with you. Just listen. Grant what we need each day in bread and insight. Subsistence for the call of growing life. Another one. Give us the food we need to grow through each new day, through each illumination of life's needs. Help us fulfill what lies within the circle of our lives. Each day we ask no more and no less. Generate through us the bread of life. We hold only what is asked to feed the next mouth. I love that one. We hold only what we need to fill the next mouth. Remember the manna of the Israelites lost in the desert? Only good for the day. You try to store it, you wake up the next morning, it's all moldy and horrible. We hold only what we need to feed the next mouth. Grant what we need each day in bread and insight. So this idea of the everythingness, this fundamental flaw in our thinking that is always pushing us out there into the future, looking for something outside this circle of possession, is what we are doing to ourselves to keep us out of this understanding of our Father and who He is. And we do it in lots of subtle ways, in ways that we don't even realize we're doing. You know, there's so many people right now, especially with all the world events going on in Egypt and across the world, in our own country, political, you know, social, economic upheavals everywhere. And so we end up focusing out into these macro areas, this macro arena, and we kind of obsess over it, you know, and we watch Fox News and MSNBC and we listen to this and that and the other thing, our favorite talk show hosts, or maybe read columns on the internet. It's all very seductive, you know, but what does it really get you in the end? Because even the President of the United States, who is in charge of these macro events, right? How does he really live his life? How does each one of us live our lives? No matter how big our scope, our lives are lived one moment at a time, one face at a time. We can only occupy this moment. So even if we're dealing with world events, you can only talk to one ambassador at a time and really deal with an issue. Where we live our lives is in the micro, within this circle of possession. And we need to stay in that circle or we lose every connection that would heal us and provide for us and take us to the next level of our lives. And then there are so many of us who are just thinking constantly about the future. You know, what if this, what if that, and trying to figure all the things out when in reality it's just this moment. You know, when we're not present in this moment, where are we? We're nowhere. And I want you to really think for a second. This moment, the one we're sitting in right now, I know I've said this before, bear with me, is the only moment that exists. This place for us is the only moment that exists. No matter where you're from, no matter what relationships you have, no matter how important they are, this circle of faces is the only one that exists for us. Nothing outside this room exists for us. If we aren't here now, we are nowhere. If your thoughts are out someplace else with your loved ones, with your worries, with your whatever, and you're not present here, you're nowhere. This is the moment. This is the day. The greatest gift that we can ever give anyone is the gift of our presence, true presence, that when they look in our eyes, they see someone looking back at them who sees them and hears them, and they know that they're being seen and heard and that somebody cares. And because you and me and everyone else on the planet can only be one place at one time, unless you've learned to bilocate, then you've said that this is the most important place for you to be, right here, right now. And that's quite a statement, isn't it? So if you're here, if your body's occupying this space, might as well bring your spirit along for the ride, huh? And really be here, because this is the only place that you will meet God. God is everywhere. God is everywhen. But everywhere is one spot. Here. And every when is one moment. Now. That's it. And it's the only place we'll find God. As soon as we exit the moment, we exit the circle of possession. We exit the stay. And we exit the connection with our God's presence. This is what Jesus is trying to get across to us. You know, He says it in so many different ways. He tells us not to worry about tomorrow. Right? Why does He do that? Because He's trying to keep us anchored here now. This is where we will find the healing that we seek. It's right here. Okay, fine. How can you do that? You know, it's great to talk about these things in theory, but what are you going to do when you walk out that door? How are you going to make this real in your lives? Great question. There is an author by the name of Leonard Sweet, who I think really has a good handle on a lot of things. He used this term in a different context, but I want to use it here today. He's talking about EPIC. E-P-I-C, and it's an acronym for him. And it stands for Experiential, Participatory, Image-Based, and communal. I want you to think about the way the modern world actually operates. Instead of experiential, we are propositional. We want to have a truth proposed to us. Here, write it all out. Give me the executive summary. Give me the flow chart. Give me the Excel spreadsheet. Here it is. I'm going to study it, and I'm going to figure it all out. You know, someone my generation or older, you give a cell phone to, what's the first thing they're going to do? Where's the owner's manual? How do I do this? Okay? Give a cell phone to someone who's under 20. What do? They take the thing, and they just start pressing buttons, you know? It's experiential for them. They're not going to sit and read a big old thick manual. They're not going to do that. They're just going to work it out. That's experience. And see, we think that we can figure life out. I'm going to sit here in this room and I'm going to pray to God for clarity and I'm not leaving till I get it. What's that going to get you? Red eyes and a headache. Believe me, I've tried. God doesn't seem to answer on command, on cue that way. Oh, yo, I'm going to read this book, this Bible, this holy book, and I'm going to figure it all out. And then what? You know, it's like we go to college and we think we're prepared to do some sort of job or profession, whether it's psychology or business or whatever. And then you realize day one that everything you know is only the very infinitesimal beginning of what you need to know to do your job. Because your job begins with your on-the-job training when you actually start doing the thing. And all your theory, it may eventually help you somewhat, but you're going to have to work it out and apply it and make it happen in your lives. Experience life. Don't try to figure it out. We want to figure it out in our heads. Faith in Hebrew wasn't about what we think, it's about what we consistently do. And so all these things in their culture were pointing to these truths. Participatory. Okay? Right now, we're doing what people normally do in the modern world. We're not participatory, we're representational. I'm sitting up here talking and you're all in neat rows listening. But once again, go to a concert where people my generation are older and this is what you see. People in neat rows listening intently to the music. Now go to a young person's concert and what do you see? Mosh pit! They are as much of the show as what is on stage. They are completely involved and immersed and just thrown into the experience of what they're doing. They're participating. We need to participate in life. This cannot be a passive sort of just receiving, a passive intake of information and call it spirituality. There needs to be an active immersing in life, in our moments. So we need to be experiential, we need to be participatory, and now we come to image-based. The modern world is word-based. We're used to reading words. But more and more our society is turning to images. And images are important because they hit us beneath the belt. They hit us beneath our heads. They get in between the cracks of our intellect. And they just present raw information to us as if we were there. And that's the power of images. Jesus used stories, verbal images, to get in between the cracks. Jesus didn't teach a theology. He didn't try to give us a theology. He tried to give us images of what the kingdom looked like so that we could go there. He was trying to get us to go there, to experience, to participate, and the images take us there. Again, our society, our children, so much more image-based. New websites, modern websites, children's websites, kids' websites, young adults' websites. How many words are on any given page? Practically none. Then you go to the old farts' websites and it's just covered with text. Just gray with text, right? We need to be image-based. We need to be thinking between the cracks of our thoughts, moving that direction. And finally, communal. We're individualistic, you know? And we think in terms of the individual. The ancient societies were communal. They thought in terms of the good of the whole. And there is a balance there, of course. But more and more, we need to be connected to each other. And we need to see that our life is going to be lived out experientially, participatory, and image-based in our relationships with each other. Epic. These are principles that we can use. But how do we actually apply them? I was thinking about this. I'm trying to think of an analogy that I could give you. And one of the ones that I came up with, and it may do nothing for you, but I'm a musician, and I was studying music for 3 years back in Illinois, and I was my performance group was jazz band, so I was tenor sax in the jazz band, and I still remember our director Paul Telosco, just a great musical director, good guy. And if you're a musician, you basically have two tools to work with, and that's it. You got rhythm, and you got pitch. That's it. You got time, and you've got melody, pitch. If you can't sing in pitch, if you can't play in pitch, then half of your tools are gone. And the same thing with your time, if you can't play in time. And so you got rhythm and pitch. And we had this one song, I think it was String of Pearls, you know, the old Glenn Miller tune, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And we kept rushing through that because there's all these spaces between the notes, and you got to play the space as much as you play the note, right? And so I remember Paul Telosco standing up in front of us and saying, okay, now imagine a conveyor belt going by, you know, and it goes by at this set level. You can't change it. It's just going by. And you just set the notes down on the conveyor belt as the conveyor belt goes by. Da, 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 da. And he was trying to get us to let time be as real to us and that space be as real to us as the notes we are actually playing. And it worked. We were better. This is a diversion, I guess, but I got to tell you. We had a jazz festival at that particular college every year, and we always brought one star player in to play with us. And since we were the host band, the star player would come in and play with us. And one year we had Louis Belson come in. I don't know if you know who Louis Belson was. He's a famous drummer on the along the level of Gene Krupa and Buddy Rich, old jazz guy. And he was married to Pearl Bailey. No? Okay. Anyway, he comes in. We had this one song that was so fast that we always slowed down as we were playing the thing. So the director got in the habit of kicking it in faster, you know, so that by the time we slowed down, we'd slow down to the right tempo and everything would be cool. So now Louis Belson's sitting in on drums instead of our usual drummer. And so he's kicking it in at the usual tempo, right? And we start playing this thing, and Belson kicks in like a metronome, like a machine. I'd never experienced a drummer like that before. And within 16 bars, everything just fell apart. We couldn't keep up with the song, you know, because he kicked in. We just started laughing. I remember Paul just busting up and saying, oh, yeah, I've got to remember now, kick it in at the right tempo. But this idea of this conveyor belt going by is I think it's useful for us. Remember that I Love Lucy episode with the candy factory? And you know, they're starting out okay at first, but they start worrying about what's coming out of the machine, and they're watching that, and they're letting a few go by, and then finally they're eating them to try to make sure that... That's what we do with our lives. You know, there is this conveyor belt that's bringing our moments to us. If we were on an assembly line with a conveyor belt going by, when our widget gets to us and we got to turn that screw a quarter turn to the left and let it go, that's all we got to do. We just got to turn that screw and let it go. If once we let it go, we're worrying about, was that a quarter turn to the right or to the left, and then the next one's coming in, or we're looking down and saying, there's no way I can keep up with this, our work is over. And we're missing exactly what it is we're supposed to be doing here. We spend so much time looking for the moments to come and worrying about them and if we're going to be adequate to them, or worrying about the job that we did in the moments that are past, that we're missing the only thing that matters is when the work gets right in front of us. Do what we're supposed to do and let it go. When Jesus said, don't worry, he said, look at the birds of the air, you know. They don't store things up into grain houses, and yet their father feeds them. Does that mean that they don't work? Does that mean that we don't have to work? I can just stay home and pray, and God is going to provide everything that I need in my little day, in my circle of possessions? No, really analyze what birds do. They spend 90% of their waking hours searching for food and eating it and dealing with it. But they don't worry about the next day. It's not possible for them. But we're supposed to emulate that. Work hard. Be responsible. Do what we do. But when that thing passes, when you've taken it as far as you can, let it go. You know, how many times have you had a project or something that you needed to do, and you'd done everything that you could, but does that stop you continuing to run that thing around in your head? We continue to do that. We continue to worry about it and think about it, and then we worry about things that haven't even happened yet. And all the time, we're missing what's going on right now. You know, the danger in losing someone like Matt Pack is that I can spend so much of my time thinking about him who is gone that I start to miss you who are here. And we do that when we grieve. And it's a process. And if you have to do that for a while to get through the process, that's fine. But your goal should be that who you're with is the most important person in your life at that moment. Be there with them. Find God's presence in that moment. Don't be thinking about the things that aren't present so that it takes you away from the things that are. Because once we do that, again, we leave God. We leave His presence. We leave the ability to be able to live. But what if? Yeah, I know. What if? But what if will be just fine to deal with when it's here now and not when it's still coming out of the machine at the beginning of the conveyor belt. This is what we're trying to understand. That from the beginning of time, God has given us everything that we will ever need to do everything we will ever have to do. There is nothing out there to get. The kingdom isn't out there to be found by observation. It's within, it's among, it's in our midst. This is where Jesus is trying to focus us. And so, one more word I want to bring to your attention, and that's havlan, which literally means give us. But my question to you then is, who's doing the giving? How do we accept this gift from God, this provision from God, this healing from God? How does it come to us, and what should we be looking for? There's the old saw about the guy on the roof as the floodwaters are coming up, praying for God to save him, and a boat comes by and says, jump in, and he says, no, God will save me. Helicopter, no, God will save you. Another boat, no, God will save me. Waters come up, and he drowns. And when he meets God, he says, why didn't you save me? I sent you two boats and a helicopter. What more do you want? What is it that we're looking for in terms of this provision? What is it that we expect? Our expectations can shelve us off from being able to accept what God has for us. The interesting thing about havlan in Aramaic is that it means literally to humanly generate, to produce with life and soul. Humanly generate. After the crucifixion, when Jesus appears to his closest friends, he asks Peter on the shore of the lake, he says, do you love me? And Peter says, well, you know I do. He says, well, then feed my sheep. And he asks him again, and he asks him a third time, and Peter's getting really upset. But he keeps saying, feed my sheep, feed my lambs, tend my sheep. If we really are your kingdom come, your will be doneing in our lives, if we really are beginning to resonate at the Father's frequency, vibrate with Him, what is important to Him is important to us, within our circle of need, who's doing the giving? I want to tell you that I believe that we are. God is never disconnected from the process, but we're the ones who do the giving. We become God's hand and feet. We are the one who execute His will for Him. And it's not about obedience, and it's not about obligation. It's who we are. And when we really are in the moment, we can see another person. We can see what they need. We can meet them at that point of need. And not just do a flyover from 30,000 feet, dropping things that we want to give them, but really looking into their eyes and giving the things that they need, even if it's just an arm around the shoulder. I called Matt's parents last night in West Virginia. What could I say? There was nothing to say. There was no explanation to give. There was no rational way of trying to understand a child's death, especially one who was on a trajectory that just looked like it was going to the moon, and now it's just cut off. All I could do was just let them hear my voice. And say, if there's anything you need on this coast, just call. And that had to be enough. And they really didn't want to talk anyway. They'd only heard hours before themselves, and I just needed to let them get off the phone. What are the needs of the person in front of you? And then what are your needs that you're telegraphing to the person in front of you? Will they see that? Can they humanly generate? Can they have lawn? One of my greatest heroes is Francis of Assisi. I just love his story. He's one of the towering figures in Christianity that I thought really got it and gets it and continues to inspire. And he wrote a prayer along these lines. And he said, "Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. And where there is sadness, joy. O Divine Master, grant that I may not so much seek to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, to be loved as to love. For it is in giving that we receive, it is in pardoning that we are pardoned, and it is in dying that we are born to eternal life." Within the circle of this day, this moment, we are one with God and one with each other. And when we're one with God and one with each other, we really are each other's answered prayer. And we can live that prayer each moment of our lives. Would you pray with me? Father, just want to hold up Larry and Lisa again, Matt's parents. It's hard for me to imagine what they're going through. But as we prayed this morning, Lord, let them know that you are present. Let them know that you are here in this horrible moment, this tragic moment in their lives. But even now, even here, that if they'll stay in the moment, if they'll lean into each other and to you, they will find a way through. Through this event, for all of us, help us to see the meaning in terms of the way that it binds our community together, brings us new insights. Let Matthew continue to inspire us, to focus us on the lived moment, on the experience of everything that is around us, to love nature, to see your face in it. Help us to learn from every moment. Everything that happens, whether we perceive it as good, bad, or indifferent, it's there to teach us and to bring us closer to you if we can stay here and now. Keep us grounded, Lord. Keep us in your presence. Help us to understand what that means more and more each day. And thank you in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay. Hey, let's all stand. And for those of you who are here for the first time, we do recite the Lord's Prayer together, but with this insight. Let it be a reminder of who we are and what we're doing with it.